Jordan's Prince Hassan bin Talal has called for a social charter to protect the rights of Christians in Arab countries.
Prince Hassan was speaking at a two-day summit that the Jordanian Royal Institute for Interfaith Studies hosted in the capital Amman last week.
Focusing on the future of Christians in the region in the wake of the Arab Spring, it drew together lay and religious Christians and Muslims from Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, Iraq, Egypt, Sudan, and Iran.
Islamic scholar Jesuit Father Samir Khalil Samir welcomed the prince's urgent call to stem the Christian exodus from the Middle East and said governments must enshrine minority rights in their constitutions.
This institute was founded by Prince Hassan bin Talal the uncle of the actual king, the brother of the previous king. And he founded it in Amman in 1994, and in a very open-minded vision. I was there three times in Amman with the prince, very personally, and really he is an extraordinary personality. His aim is to create a real interfaith dialogue, hearing the other and explaining and answering the questions from both sides. And a specific interest of this institute, as they say in their constitution, is a particular reference to Christianity in Arab and Islamic society. There, he personally, the prince, wrote a book, a small book, in at least three or four languages about Arab Christians, the history of Arab Christians, showing the importance they had in the culture, in the spirituality, in the development of the Arab world. And this is why he promoted this initiative personally. He was present and asking, he had chosen Christians from Syria, Iraq, Palestine, Jordan, a small group of well-known open-minded Christians with the same from the Muslim side, Jordan Muslims, who are known for their culture and their opening. And the question was arise now because everybody in the Arab world is asking himself what is going on in the Arab world. What we called in the whole world the Arab Spring. The question is it still a spring? It started as such because the movement was led by young people who wanted to change. But the change and this movement was taken out from other people, from the Muslim tendency, the two Islamistic group, the Muslim Brotherhood from one side and the Salafist from the other side. They recuperate this energy, and because they are more organized than the youth who were not organized, they are able to take the power. And this is what is happening in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Libya, and in other countries. In Syria, something similar was happening. A popular revolution against this dictatorial regime, and we have to say that it is dictatorial, but after some months, with the help of Saudi Arabia and of the Republic of Qatar, both traditionalists, they changed their line, going more and more in the line of an Islamistic regime against the secular regime of Bashar al-Assad. And so we have a radical change in the Arab world, and everybody is afraid of this change. Now, this is the situation for all Arabs, most Arabs, I mean. But in this situation, the weakest part of the society are the Christians. Numerically, they don't exceed 10%, except in Lebanon. And in many parts, is only 2 to 3%. So they are too weak to protect themselves. And what happens is that a lot of them are going to Canada, America, Australia, Europe, leaving the Muslim world, the Arab world. And this is the danger. That's why the Prince Hassan asked for a meeting to change this and to stop this movement and to tell to Christians, please remain in this area. We need you. You are a part of this, of our Arab society. You are true Arabs, as he said very clearly. You are Arabs. You contributed to the Arab civilization more than anybody else. We need you. Remain. The conditions to remain is to be recognized practically by the constitutions as true citizens, having the same rights of citizenship and equality of everybody. But this is the weak point in the Muslim societies. They consider usually that Muslims are automatically the highest citizens, those who had to command. The others, practically Christians, Jews, they have to be under the authority of the first group. This was already thought so by the founder of Islam, Muhammad himself. He distinguished in the society three groups: the believers, that means the Muslims, the unbelievers, they had to be fought until they die or they convert to Islam. These were called the kuffar, plural of kafir. And the third group is in between, the Christians and the Jews. These are called dhimmi, which means protected on the basic, on the condition that they remain submitted to the first group. So this is still happening today, even if officially there is no more dhimmi and ummi, but in fact they deal like that, that you are certainly citizen, but in fact you are second-class citizens. And many Christians are fed up with this situation and they leave if they can.
Father Samir, in fact, Prince Hassan bin Talal has called for what he describes as an Arab social charter to help protect and, shall we say, promote the Christian presence in Arab countries.
Right.
In your opinion, as a scholar of Islam, as someone who was born and who has lived in these countries and has a great experience of this culture, what must this Arab social charter entail to ensure that the Christian presence can remain in the Middle East?
It could be said in an easy way, just to apply the Human Rights Charter, which is in fact not applied. I mean the UNO Charter of 48. And equality, absolute equality between all groups, religious groups, sexual groups, any kind of groups, between men and women, between believers and unbelievers, between Muslims and non-Muslims. And this is the first point. The other point is to recognize the absolute equality of all persons, whether they are rich or poor, and the democracy. The problem is that most Muslims would say, well, democracy is something typically Muslims, because we had the Shura. The Shura is the consultation that Muhammad was said to have done with some people. But this has nothing to do with democracy. This is just one aspect, a small one. They say, we don't make any difference. But if you read the Quran, you see that there are a lot of differences between the categories I mentioned, believers and unbelievers, men and women, Muslims and non-Muslims, and so on. Even the race is not mentioned, but in fact, Arabs are considering themselves, we are considering ourselves as the highest and the best group. And also the Quran is comforting this approach by saying, you are the best nation ever came out in the world. And the you could be understood as you Muslims or you Arabs. So what we need is a new charter, like the charter of the United Nations, and just accept the normal, the universal principles. But Muslims tend to go back in every point to the Quran, and the Quran is reflecting the situation of the 7th century in the Arab desert.
In fact, Father Samir, speaking last year about another document in defense of democracy and religious freedom released by Al-Azhar University, you spoke about the fact that until there is a revisitation of the interpretation of the Quran within the Muslim world, we can't really speak about any progress or move forward. But yeah. Prince Hassan has also called for Al-Azhar to hold a meeting on this issue, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it's true. When we speak in abstract, Muslims will use this terminology. They would say, we defend democracy and religious freedom and so on. If you go further, if you say, okay, religious freedom, Al-Azhar didn't mention the conversion, the possibility of converting from Islam, for instance, to Christianity or Judaism. They never mentioned the atheist, the possibility of being non-believer. And this belonged to religious freedom. But they spoke generally. In the Constitution, if we observe the Sharia, as it is normally a precept in the Egyptian Constitution, for instance, the Article 2, pretend that the basis of all laws is the Sharia. The Sharia, if we apply it literally, you have to kill the apostate. The apostate means the Muslim who abandoned Islam to adopt another religion. If he don't proclaim his change, if he proclaim he is Muslim, even if he is not a believer, he could live. But if he proclaim, I am a Christian, then he must be killed. Now, where is religious freedom? Even in Egypt, where Al-Azhar proclaimed it, in fact, is theoretical. It's just to say, we are open-minded, we are, and so on. Recently, last week, the great Imam of Saudi Arabia, who is the leading country, Muslim country in the world, And the Imam of the great Imam of Mecca said, we cannot accept any church on the ground of the Peninsula Arabica. That means, and he was answering to someone asking him from Kuwait, you have to destroy all the churches which are on your ground in Kuwait or elsewhere in this area. Based not on fanaticism. He says, no, I am applying the Sharia because there is a hadith, that means a saying attributed to the founder Muhammad. There is a hadith which says in Arabia there cannot be two religions, which means there is only one, which is Islam. So my suggestion is we don't need general affirmations. We are for democracy. We are for religious freedom. These are words, and we are fed up with words. We need change in the constitution, change in the laws, in the practice, and so on. The Christian knows all these affirmations. We heard that in the Arab world. We are hearing that since centuries. The question is, we want to apply the international, the universal norms between man and man, men and women, and so on.
Father Samir, before my final question is this, as you pointed out, Prince Hassan is an exemplary figure of those great academics, those great scholars, those great men of religion in Islam. And he assembled other religious leaders and academics from both the Christian sphere in the Arab countries and the Islamic sphere in the Arab countries. But they're all moderates, as you pointed out.
Yes.
Do you think their voice is going to be heard? Is heard? Do you think any attention is going to be paid to them by the other fringes within the Muslim and Christian world there?
It's very important what he is doing. Now, his voice is one voice. It's very easy to say, well, he is a liberal Muslim. And this is a kind of accuse. They say he is liberal, but it doesn't mean he is not a good Muslim. I remember a meeting, we were there during the Lent. It was 2 years ago. And he had the delicateness to prepare, to ask to Christian women to prepare something for the Lent beside the common eating. And we had plenty of different meats for Lent prepared by Christian women. And for the Muslims or those who didn't want to have Lent, they had something else, and both were wonderful. This is the delicacy of Prince Hassan. Dialogue is dialogue in truth and respect.
Of course, you were born in Egypt. You are Egyptian.
Yes, I'm Egyptian. I belong to the Coptic Church.
Exactly. So can I ask you perhaps for your personal memories of Pope Shenouda and what this means for the Coptic Church?
Pope Shenouda was very beloved in Egypt by most Christians. Not by all of them. He was rather traditionalist. He was also authoritarian. But he was a spiritual man. He was someone who knew the Bible in Arabic by heart, with chapters and verses. He was full of the spirit of the monks of the desert, of the ascetes. He could explain spontaneously any passage of the Bible based on the examples of the holy people in the Bible, in the history of Christianity, the monks, and so on. So, and he was very popular. He he was someone who could also laugh with you. I remember I was very, very often with him in the desert, as in the patriarchate, as in meetings, since before he became patriarch. That means since the 60s, we were working together in the Middle East Council of Churches, and I was even the head of a small section called Theological Education Fund, and he, as a bishop, was a member of it. And it was very, very open-minded, simple, even in his approach to Christianity. As I said, he was traditional. In interpreting the Bible, he was rather literalist. But this corresponds also to our mentality in Egypt. Most people are literalist. They don't interpret the Bible in a symbolic way if there is a kind of contradiction with the science and so on. He was a good, open-minded to Muslims. In ecumenism, he was not the best example, because he had this impression that Catholics and Protestants wanted to make proselytism and to take some of his children, as he used to say. So he was not confident, apart in some private cases in general, to the other churches. But he was a great figure of, he marked the history. He had conflict with Sadat, and it was very hard for him. But then with Mubarak, it was the opposite. He make agreements with him. He reached an agreement on building churches, because you know that it's almost impossible in Egypt to build a Christian church. You need so many permissions and exceptions that, in fact, you never do it legally. So he reached an agreement with the president that he could build yearly so and so many churches, let us say around 50 churches a year, to correspond to the development of the democracy, the demography in the Coptic Church. And this was the fruit of a good relation with the president, as also he had a good relation with Al-Azhar University and the imam. And he was able to speak wonderfully Arabic with Islamic terms also. And he could have discussions on the Quran and on the Muslim belief, and to clarify the difficult points of the Christian belief. So it was a great figure. Now, we don't know who will come. We hope that someone, the one who will be chosen by the Synod, the Holy Synod, will be open-minded and in the same time a spiritual person, having both intellectual formation, theological formation, and spiritual background. This is what we hope.